Catskill.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Dan Hoos, communications director from Sullivan County Government, is here with the latest from Monticello, including a blood drive today to help meet the desperate need for blood in the region. The New York Supreme Court upholds the right of local foie gras farms to sell the duck delicacy in New York City. Sullivan County is home to two of the largest foie gras producers in America, La Belle Farms and Hudson Valley Foie Gras. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio reports. And the Wayne County Arts Alliance, Arts Alliance's first member-curated exhibit. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaks to fiber artist Katharina Lickman and Buff McAllister about their careers spent exploring textiles and collage design. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Biden will campaign today in North Carolina, and former President Donald Trump will campaign in Virginia after last night's debate. There's been a lot of response to President Biden's debate performance. He's been criticized for his raspy voice, his facial appearance, and moments where he appeared to lose his train of thought. NPR's Domenica Montanaro says a lot of that concern is coming from Biden's fellow Democrats.
The elephant in the room was that Democrats really were very nervous about the performance that Joe Biden gave. People close to him on the record were talking about how this was a disappointing effort. You know, his campaign said that he had a cold. That's why his voice was hoarse. He sounded weak, somewhat feeble. And the problem with that is it plays into his key vulnerability, which is his age and his competency.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro reporting. Separately, Trump is getting criticism for making statements that were vague enough to be misleading, and then he lied. That includes Trump's comments about fraud in the 2020 presidential election, and Trump claimed that Biden encouraged Russia to invade Ukraine. Those statements are false. Iranians are voting to replace the late President Ibrahim Raisi. He died last month in a helicopter crash. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports the contest features two conservative hardliners and one reformist candidate.
Iran's Guardian Council, tasked with vetting candidates, approved six hardliners, but three have since dropped out in hopes of consolidating support behind a single candidate. Parliament Speaker Mohammed Bakr Khalibaf and former nuclear negotiator Saeed Jalili are seen as the top hardline contenders, while reform-minded voters may opt for Masoud Pezeshkian, the lone reformist in the race. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei cast his vote shortly after the polls opened and once again called for high turnout. Voter disinterest in the election appears to be running high, however, with analysts saying Iranians have largely lost faith in the ballot box as a means of effecting change. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
Stocks opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported cooler inflation last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 100 points in early trading.
Consumer prices in May were up 2.6% from a year ago, a smaller annual increase than the month before. That's according to the Commerce Department's inflation yardstick, which is closely watched by the Federal Reserve. Prices actually fell slightly between April and May, stripping out volatile food and energy costs. So-called core prices rose a scant 0.1% during the month. Personal income rose by 0.5% last month, mainly thanks to rising wages. Personal spending rose just 0.2%. That allowed people to sock away a little bit more of their paychecks. The personal savings rate inched up to a still low 3.9%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. The Iowa Supreme Court has taken action on a state abortion law. The Iowa justices have overturned a temporary block, and they will allow a state law to take effect. It bans abortions in Iowa as soon as 6 weeks into pregnancy, before many women realize they are pregnant. The top education official in Oklahoma says he is requiring all public schools to teach the Bible to students. Beth Wallace of State Impact Oklahoma reports. It's not clear how Superintendent Ryan Walters' mandate will work.
Walters announced the policy change at Oklahoma's State Board of Education meeting Thursday, and he spoke more on it afterward.
With the mandate today, we're the first state in the country to require the Bible be in every classroom.
and the Bible be taught from in every classroom.
In a memo to school districts and comments to reporters, Walters clarified the mandate will apply in social studies and English and in 5th through 12th grades. He says more guidance is on the way. It's unclear whether the state superintendent has the authority to mandate the teaching of the Bible. Under Oklahoma state law, only school districts can make decisions on curriculum and materials. The directive is getting pushback from groups advocating for separation of church and state. For NPR News, I'm Beth Wallace in Tulsa.
Sweltering heat is still bearing down on the middle of the country in the south. Almost the entire state of Oklahoma is under some sort of National Weather Service warning because of the soaring temperatures and rising heat index values. Kansas, Texas, and Louisiana are also going to be hot today. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Friday, and every Friday we hear from Dan Hoost, who's the communications director at Sullivan County Government, joining us in studio here in Liberty. Hello.
Wonderful Friday morning to you. It's a beautiful day out there
today.
Lovely. It really is.
We made it through the heat wave of last week, and we've had a couple of nice days. Let's talk about what's going on. There was no legislature meeting yesterday as scheduled.
Nope.
There won't be one next week because of the July 4th holiday.
Correct.
Still plenty going on, including a blood drive today at the government center. There's a desperate need for blood in the county, in the region, across the country, actually.
Yeah. Organizers have asked me to mention this wherever I go, even just finding people in the hallway kind of thing, because it's that desperate a need. We are having a blood drive. Actually, it's happening as we speak, running till 2:30 today in the hearing room on the second floor of the government center in Monticello. And I know it's last minute notice, but that's how desperate the need is. We really need people to turn out for these blood drives. If you can't make this one, it won't be the last one. I don't have an update on when the next one is, but you certainly can go on to rcblood.org. That's rcblood.org. See more of what's going on. That really stands for RedCrossBlood.org.
Yeah.
But you can see where there will be upcoming blood drives. If you can make today's, they would be more than grateful, especially our wellness committee, which was part of the group that set this up.
And just to put a fine point on how desperate this need is, the New York Blood Center in the city actually issued a blood emergency as hospitals scrambled to fill their blood banks. They said in the last 3 weeks, donations were 2,100 pints short of what is needed at those area of hospitals, and that's just for the New York metro area.
Mm-hmm.
Previously, we've heard about a regional shortage from the New York Red Cross, and then, of course, nationally because of just shortages that have been going on since, some of the pandemic after effects.
Yes.
And other needs. So again, that blood drive is today. One more time. What time?
Today till 2:30 p.m. in the hearing room of the government center right there in Monticello. We'd love to see you.
All right. Your emergency management group, EMS Fly Cars. We talked about this last time, and the last time I keep saying flying cars.
Yeah, not flying cars.
Every time I see it, I keep getting, why are we getting flying cars? It's so cool. It's like the Jetsons. But no, these are fly cars. And again, let's explain to people what these are and how important they are for first responders.
Sure. Fly cars, a layperson like me might call them mini ambulances, but they do not do any transport of patients. So an ambulance will be following along behind any of these that we put into play, but they are fully stocked with all sorts of emergency medical supplies. We are getting a total of four. Later this year, I believe they'll start up on a contract the county legislature has approved to enter into with Senior Care EMS. It's a Bronx-based agency that does this kind of thing for profit. This will be a supplement to our local ambulance corps. They will not compete with them. They will not try to steal any kind of calls from them. But they may very well be able to get to the scene quicker than an ambulance can. The ambulance will still have to come in a lot of these calls because they'll need to be transported to a hospital. So this is an assistive plan, not a replacement plan for anything. There's still a continuing issue, a need for volunteers in our local ambulance corps. We are just trying to supplement what has been dwindling numbers for them, although I certainly hope that we can continue to encourage people to volunteer with their local agencies. So we will be working hand in hand with them. Our 911 center will be the focal point doing the dispatching. Our 911 director, Alex Rao, is also our Bureau of EMS director. So he's been working with our Public Safety Commissioner, Scott Schulte, and especially our legislator, Louis Alvarez, who has been a police officer for many, many years. This is something very close to his heart because he's been on the scene waiting sometimes for ambulances to arrive. And through no fault of the ambulance corps, they're very, very busy. This is not to paint a bad picture of the people who are working as hard as they can to provide us with that emergency medical service. But everyone agrees something needs to be done. So starting later this year, these four cars are going to be stationed in strategic spots around the county. My understanding is actually they won't always just be sitting in a spot. They may be, for lack of a better word, patrolling as well, just sort of being around our areas that are maybe less served by immediate ambulance access. So.
There are four, as you said. Two of them are going to be capable of basic life support, and then two capable of advanced life support. Mm-hmm. They don't carry passengers, right? These are just meant to dispatch. No,
they can.
Okay.
There's a driver who'll be an EMT. They might also be able to pick up a paramedic en route from like the local ambulance corps, who has even more training than an EMT.
But patients, I meant. So it's not a traditional ambulance.
They cannot transport patients. They will not be transporting patients, but they will be bringing staff and equipment to the scene that an ambulance probably would be equipped with, just not the bed inside to manage the patient care on the way back to the hospital.
Legislators, when approving this investment in these fly cars, mm-hmm. mentioned that this is a crisis in the county, given the mm-hmm. size of the county, and that folks could in some places be waiting up to an hour or more.
Yes.
And so this is to help alleviate some of that problem. Do you think it's going to alleviate the whole problem, or do we need more?
No, of course not. Even with the EMS community, the efficacy of this solution is being debated. We're really going to see how it goes. This first, I think we have a 2-year contract, $2.7 million a year. So it's a significant cost to the county and thus its taxpayers, but it's a matter of life and death. And we had to stop sitting around and just talking about it and debating it and figure out a path to go in. So this is the path that the legislature and our public safety officials have chosen. We hope it's going to be a good solution. We do not at all think it's going to be the complete solution, but better to have a fly car with a paramedic or an EMT on site with you waiting for that ambulance rather than you waiting all alone, waiting for an ambulance to arrive.
What's the protocol within the local EMT corps? Like these won't supersede those folks.
No.
If they are able to answer the call, they'll answer the call. Is that right?
Yes. Our local volunteer and paid corps are absolutely crucial to the success of this plan. We have to work hand in hand with them. We want to work hand in hand with them. If it were up to us, we would just somehow magically wave a wand and have volunteers just filling their ambulance garages saying, when can we go? But that's not the reality. So we're trying to do sort of, I guess you could call it a bit of a hybrid system here, but in a way that respects and preserves local corps and their districts' integrity and, for lack of a better word, territory, I guess, as you will, because we do not want this to cause harm to our ambulance corps.
We're speaking to Dan Hoost. He's the communications director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday with an update from Monticello. Also in first responder news, we're talking about the burn tower at the training center, which firefighters use to practice. There are some repairs and upgrades going on there.
Yeah, through Assemblywoman Aileen Gunther, we got a grant, $100,000 of that from the state. We're going to be using to Repair and upgrade our burn tower. It gets burned on a regular basis.
I was going to say, it's because you keep burning it?
Yeah. We can't help it. It's how we train our firefighters and our emergency response personnel. Very effective. It sits with our emergency operations center over near the county airport. It's been around for decades. And from time to time, we have to upgrade it and certainly repair it because we continue to burn it. The actual steel superstructure never gets burned out, but inside there's pieces of wood, there's special insulation, fire retardant insulation, and other things that we use to try to create a realistic simulation for firefighters to practice in. Sometimes it's just smoke, sometimes there's flame, sometimes it's a combination of all of that. And we want to make sure that they are getting effective training at this site. So we're thankful to our state representative, Gunther, for getting us that funding so it won't cost local taxpayers anything. And I think in September we're planning to have an actual rededication ceremony. So that should be pretty cool.
And you're also using it to train youth, the emergency services youth academy.
Yeah, that's coming up in about a month from now. We're going to have a week-long academy for 14 to 16 year olds. We I think have 9 who successfully applied. There were some others who wanted to, but hey, teenagers work during the summer as well. So this is a pilot program. We hope that this is going to encourage more young people to get involved in maybe a future summer academy that we have, and certainly also to get them involved in our local ambulance corps, our fire departments, and even maybe a career in, for example, law enforcement. I'm going to be with them virtually every day shooting video and audio of what they're doing. So stay tuned. It should be pretty exciting to see. I think it will include the burn tower. And I think they're going to be able to deal with things like they'll really actually be using a fire hose or a fire extinguisher. We're not going to put them in life-threatening situations, but we are going to give them an up-close and personal look at how our first responders do what they do.
Last time we were here, last Friday, we were speaking about the discussion at the legislature, staggered terms for the legislature. I wasn't sure when that was going to come up for discussion. Now it looks like there's something on the calendar.
Almost. They've got to fully approve it in the next meeting, but I believe in August there's going to be a public hearing, and I wanted to explain staggered terms a little bit to people. Right now, our county legislature, which consists of 9 members, are all up for election at the same time. And there has long been debate and discussion about whether that's wise or not. So far, we have not seen all 9 be replaced all in one fell swoop. But that's the concern, that if all 9 were, that there would be basically no institutional continuity of institutional knowledge. There we go, on the legislature. Yeah. You know, the staff stays the same. So it wouldn't be the end of the world if that happened. But there's a big learning curve. Ask any of the new legislators. Some of them will probably tell you they're still figuring things out. And by my experience, it takes about a year for them to really understand all the nuances of being a legislator. And so the idea here is, can we stagger the terms so that maybe, for example, one of the ideas is 3 legislators are up 1 year, 3 legislators are up another year, 3 legislators are up another year. Complicating that, however, is Governor Hochul's new thing that's saying these elections, these local elections have to happen on, I believe, even numbered years, if I recall correctly, that's what she's been saying. So we've got to figure out how that'll all work into it. Because if we do staggered terms, we can't necessarily have an election for legislators every year. It might have to be every other year. So by August, we should have several options to show to people so that they can weigh in on it. And the public can say, I like this, I don't like that, and see where we go. But I think it seems like the majority of the legislature right now is leaning towards creating these staggered terms. The tough part is who gets the short end of the stick, because several somebodies on the legislature are going to have a shorter term than other legislators so that we can get this rolling.
In late December, Hochul actually signed into law the even year election law, which moves multiple county and town elections from odd numbered years to even numbered years with the goal of reducing voter fatigue. However, over the past few months, 8 counties have sued the state asking the court to block the law. So, we'll see.
I don't think it's been blocked yet, though. So no. We're going to create plans based upon that continuing to be the law, it'll be easy to modify it if it doesn't. But again, I think the bigger thing will be, and the thing we'll all be interested to watch, is when they pick names out of a hat or draw straws or whatever to see who gets like a 3-year term or a 2-year term, or it's, you know, right now all the terms are 4 years.
Yeah.
But again, to set up staggered terms, somebody's going to have a shorter term.
The governor said that voter turnout is higher for local elections held in even numbered years because many people are already planning on voting. This is an even numbered year. There was a primary on Tuesday here in Sullivan County just for the Republican for the 100th district to replace the seat that Aileen Gunther is vacating. The Democratic seat has already been determined. That was Paula Kay. And then this Tuesday's election was between the two GOP candidates, Lou Ingracia and Camille O'Brien. Lou Ingracia came out on top. But I would argue that voter turnout wasn't very high for that. No. It looks like it was pretty low.
Yeah, and we sort of expected that, although I think I was impressed that we had 155 people show up in early voting. And then I think we got close to 1,000 total. So most people still came for the primary election at their polling site. I did want to give a quick little shout out to our Board of Elections for all the work they put into it. People don't realize they basically work just as hard putting together a low turnout primary election as they do for a high turnout, like we expect this November, presidential general election. So there's really maybe only a difference afterwards in the amount of votes to be tallied. But the prior work, it's still over a week worth of early voting, plus opening up our polling stations throughout the county. So they really worked hard. They had a lot of explaining to do with folks because we had Democrats who were like, well, why don't I have a primary? It's like, I don't know why you don't have it, but just don't show up.
You don't have to poll. Do it.
They had, I think, over in the town of Neversink, which isn't in the 100th Assembly District, right. We had people show up, and we had to tell them, no, actually, there's no polling open here because there's no primary in the 101st Assembly District, which Neversink is in. So there's a lot of work to be done. I am proud and privileged to work alongside them in helping educate the public. Elections have always been interesting and exciting to me. It's part of the democratic process. And they are at the core of helping ensure that our elections are free and fair properly tallied.
And not over yet, folks. We've got the general coming up, and there will be more to come. We'll talk to you and the Board of Elections about that as we move forward. We're going to continue to move forward with you this Friday, but let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with more. With Dan Hoost, Communications Director at Sullivan County, Democrat, Sullivan County Government, used to work at the Democrat. This is Radio Chatsco.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
This is Thane Peterson, host of Living Jazz. Saturday at noon, I bring you 2 hours of the very best of the current jazz scene, along with a little bit of classic jazz thrown into the mix. It's wonderful music that will warm your heart and soothe your soul. Join me for Living Jazz, noon to 2 Saturday, only on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and we're with Dan Hoost, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. We have a shout-out to the Board of Elections. You want to give another shout-out to another member of the legislature.
Well, yeah, our legislator, Louis Alvarez, went over to, I think it was Poughkeepsie, over to Bard College, where La Voz magazine, which is the Hudson Valley's Spanish language publication. I don't think they might have done some things with JFF before, have they?
We carry La Voz en breve every Monday night at 11, which is their sort of synopsis week in review type show, is every Monday night at 11. So we have had that on for a few years, and We just did an interview with Marielle Fiore, who is the publisher of La Voz, and also the host of La Voz en Breve, and you know, to commemorate their 20th anniversary.
Yes, and that was part of what this event was to commemorate it. And we had a Monticello resident. Her name is Alejandra Sanchez Sermon, who, as I think I put it in the email to you, one of those people who none of us actually knows, but is doing incredible work right under our noses.
Yes.
She is a tutor for preschoolers and elementary students in Monticello, Liberty, and Fallsburg. She's originally from Argentina. She is a U.S. resident, bilingual, beloved by the local immigrant community because she is the one that really teaches their children and helps acculturate them to English and the American experience and everything, but also preserves and promotes their traditions, cultures, and heritages because she comes from that background as well. She is just an incredible lady. Our legislator, Luis Alvarez, is one of those privileged folks to know her. And so he was glad to go to this event in Poughkeepsie and give her a certificate of recognition from the legislature in addition to the award she was getting from La Voz. Just, again, one of those people that you may not know personally, but when you find out who she is and what she's doing, raising her family here in Monticello, you're just so glad to call them a neighbor and sort of hope your paths cross at some point. So congratulations, Alejandra.
Congratulations to her. Congratulations to Marielle Fiore and La Voz and the entire team there for 20 years of bringing that news and information and culture to the Hispanic community throughout the Hudson Valley.
Absolutely.
It's not easy. It's print, it's online, it's the radio show, and they do a great job.
So they really do.
Congratulations. Let's talk about what's going on this weekend at the county museums. They're open throughout the area. They're open for free.
Yeah, actually, it's not this week. It's coming up July 27th through the 28th.
That is? So. Oh, July. I've got June on my brain.
Did I put June in there?
No, you put July.
I put July.
You put July, but today June 28th, so I thought it was this weekend.
No, July 27th through the 28th. So
mark,
I'll be mentioning
calendar
this again. Yes, Museum Weekend throughout Sullivan County. This has been put together, I believe, by Donna Steffens every year from the Time in the Valleys Museum in Grahamsville. And she is gracious enough to include our county museums. Most of our county parks and attractions are free to visit, including our county museum in Hurleyville, even though we will be part of this Museum Weekend. But Fort Delaware, for example, the Museum of Colonial History in Narrowsburg, which is run by our partner, the Delaware Company, but the county owns it, they do have an admission fee. Well, that will be waived for July 27th through the 28th as part of this. Hey, hit up all our museums in Sullivan County. It is amazing how many we have. I believe there's, 9 museums participating in this. And people are like, wait a minute, where are all these museums? But they actually are from, you've got the Catskill Fly Fishing Center and Museum in Livingston Manor to, like I said, Fort Delaware and Narrowsburg, our DNH, the Delaware and Hudson Canal Interpretive Center in Summitville, which is an incredible museum. It's small, but it's great. And you can bring the kids because if they get bored in the building, there's the towpath and bridges and an old lock that they can all explore right outside its doors. So each of these museums have something really interesting to convey to the community. Encourage everyone to keep this on their calendar or visit them in the meantime.
July 27th.
July 27th through the 28th.
But yes, you could visit one of them sooner than that. Fort Delaware is celebrating Independence Day.
Yes. Yes, the Delaware Company is putting on Independence Day or an Independence Day event on Saturday, July 6th at 3 p.m. Oliver King is going to deliver the Frederick Douglass speech, What to the Slave is the 4th of July. But you don't have to wait till then. If you want, on Thursday, July 4th, the county historian, John Conway, will present a program titled A Settlement Divided, talking about how the settlement that the fort represents in the Narrowsburg Coshectan area, it was called the Cushetunk Settlement, which I think is where the Coshectan name comes from, there were people who still wanted to remain under British rule versus folks who wanted to become independent. So there were some pretty tough issues that had to be resolved, and I think not always friendly were they resolved? Obviously, we know how they were resolved in the end. But, of course, on the 6th will be Oliver King. If you have not heard him perform, he is absolutely amazing. And he brings it from the slave, the black perspective from that time. And then the following Saturday, July 13th, is Patriots and Loyalists Day at the fort, highlighted by the reading aloud of the Declaration of Independence, followed by a Tory British support response and interactions among the Cushitunk settlers, most of whom, as I said, were content to remain under British rule. So this uncovers a really interesting part of our history. We may think the country is divided now, but back then, even before I guess there technically was a United States of America, there were some pretty deep divisions.
Sounds like it.
Yes.
All kinds of celebrations all next week. County offices closed on Thursday.
Mm-hmm. Closed on Thursday, but we're open on Friday, July 5th.
Oh, yeah.
Not a lot of people necessarily know that. And that to me, I mean, everyone expects us to be closed on Thursday. Of course, it's Independence Day. But we will be open Friday, July 5th if you need to get some business done.
Well, that means we'll get to see you next Friday here, too.
You will.
All right. Thanks. Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government joins us every Friday. Have a great weekend.
You too.
We'll take a break. When we come back, an update on the foie gras ban in New York City. It's been overturned. Radio Catskills Patricio Rubio will have updates on that development right after this break. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, it's Rosie Starr, host of Farm and Country. Join us Saturdays at 10 a.m. on Radio Catskill for stories about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. Feed your ears some good radio produce. Listen local.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. In a major win for Sullivan County's duck farms, the New York Supreme Court in Albany has reversed New York City's 2019 ban on foie gras sales. LaBelle Farms and Hudson Valley Foie Gras, both located in Ferndale, New York, contested the ban, arguing that it unjustly targeted their farming practices and threatened the livelihood of over 500 employees who rely on foie gras production. Radio Catskills' Patricia Rubio reports on the development with reactions from elected officials, animal rights activists, and interviews with one of the farm's owners regarding this Supreme Court ruling.
In a major win for Sullivan County's duck farms, the New York Supreme Court in Albany has overturned New York City's 2019 ban on foie gras sales. The court ruled that the city law violated state and agricultural laws meant to protect farming practices and support agricultural trade. The local law, named 202 in 2019, was passed by the New York City Council and it sought to ban the sale of the product in the city due to animal welfare concerns over the force-feeding method used in production. LaBelle Farms and Hudson Valley Foie Gras are two of the largest producers of this product in the United States, and both are located in Ferndale, New York, in Sullivan County. They challenged the ban. They argued that it unfairly targeted their farming methods and put their business at risk. These farms employ over 500 workers who depend on the foie gras production. Here is Sergio Cervera, president of LaBelle Farms, upon hearing the news of the court's decision.
It's a huge relief. I don't even have words for it. When Ed sent it to me, it didn't sink in for a while. It really didn't sink in because, you know, I was expecting to, you know, always fighting and fighting. You never expect something to go that way. You know, the decision is very well written and it went over everything. And it's amazing to me that someone finally heard us.
And Sergio, you've been fighting for this for such a long time. You've been going to a number of hearings. I went with you down in 2019 to the steps of the city hall to protest this. And you also mentioned in the past to me that you pleaded with the New York City Council to come up to Sullivan County to see how you farm, but they did not. And of course, now with this decision from the New York State Supreme Court, that New York City cannot dictate what happens in Sullivan County when it comes to your type of business.
That's exactly what I always argue too, because of how you're mentioning that. I said that we did go to every council member in New York City. We didn't get anything from them. They never came. And then the Sullivan County legislature, when Louis was the chairman, they went, they saw the whole operation and they put their support behind us. Same thing with the ag commissioner. The ag commissioner actually came out. He sent his people out and they're like, okay, look at this farm. Is it a farm? Is it a farming practice? And they determined the same thing and they went on our side. So the ones that took the time to see who we are, what we are, sided with us. The ones that just wanted to either for a vote play politics or whatever it was that they were doing, they ruled against us without knowing how we farm or the kind of people that work for us, the families that we take care of here in the county. It's a tremendous amount. And I don't think they understand that because they're so big, New York City. Like Sullivan County is a small county. It's very poor compared to the rest of the counties. And there's over 500 people now that are employed by these two farms.
Animal rights activists and New York City officials criticized the ruling, arguing that it undermines the efforts to address animal cruelty. Voters for Animal Rights told Radio Catskill that this decision is inconsistent with the national trend of local governments acting on the behalf of the ethical concerns of its citizens. We are hopeful that New York City will appeal this misguided ruling, and Voters for Animal Rights strongly believes there is no place in a moral society for the sale of products of violent force feeding of ducks and geese. We will continue to speak for them to end their suffering. Foie gras is made by feeding mallard ducks a fatty cornmeal diet through a tube in their final weeks before slaughter. This process enlarges the duck's liver, which is then sold at a high price. Additionally, other parts of the duck, such as bones, carcasses, and feathers, are also used and sold for different products, such as dog food and pillows. Once the ban was approved in 2019, the farms requested a review of the ban by the Department of Agriculture and Markets. And in August of 2020, the department's initial review found that the local laws violate the state law in protecting farm operations from local laws that restrict farm operations unreasonably. Saravia says they are grateful for the New York Commissioner of Agriculture and Markets for protecting their livelihoods and for the courts recognizing the importance of the state's agricultural practices. In the decision brought down from the New York State Supreme Court, the court also found that New York City's interest in animal welfare does not override the state's policy to support agricultural activities. The ruling emphasized that the state law protects farming operations from local laws that would unreasonably interfere with their practices. The court also denied motions from various animal rights organizations to intervene as petitioners, allowing them to only participate as friends of the court. Here's Sergio again.
It's huge. One, that it shows you can be in New York City, do this stuff to us, and we don't have the luxury to stop fighting because so many families depend on it. So it doesn't matter what size or what municipality you are, we have to put up a fight because it's so many families that are so close to us and directly related that depend on these farms. And you can't just walk away from it. So I hope they get that understanding that no matter what state or what city decides to do it, we are going to put up a fight because we have to.
Serge, you told me in the past that if the ban took effect, it's a possibility you may have to shut down operations, you along with Hudson Valley Foie Gras, and lay off workers because the amount of money and the amount of sales that is made in New York City from your products alone. I know you distribute worldwide, you distribute throughout the United States, but one of the biggest markets is New York City. Have you had a chance to relate this news to the workers? And if you could tell me what was their reaction?
They're all, the ones that I've spoken to are extremely happy because they're in the same thing that we are. You know, that this is what they've been doing for years, 20 plus years. So they're happy. They don't have to worry about where am I going to get my next paycheck from? Where am I going to go work? How is the boss going to be there? How are my kids going to get their clothes? How am I going to pay the rent? Especially now. When you look at how the rents are going up and how all that's happening here in the county, it's a tremendous pressure. You just have to think, okay, where am I going to work? Where am I going to live? So for them to know that the Supreme Court and the judge decided in our favor and now they can breathe a little bit, it's huge.
Right. Yeah. Now has I guess this case also set a precedence of for other farms. You mentioned in the past that if this was to not go in your favor, what this could mean for other farmers if one day someone feels beef shouldn't be sold in New York City, and how that would affect the beef farmers or cattle farmers, things like that.
And it does, because we've seen it like in California. So the fact that they stood up for us here is a tremendous win for all farmers, because these things are being done based on ideology, and it shouldn't be based on ideology. You should look at what you're legislating against and what you're destroying, because every farming has some aspect of that animal's going to get slaughtered, or that whatever it is that you're doing, it's going to get used for its purpose. So if you allow them to do this to us, there's no end. And even like the court ruling states, like then it'll be eggs, then it'll be pork. It keeps going and going. It's like a slippery slope that you won't be able to stop. It just keeps going.
So what happens from here? Are you, I guess, now putting this behind you, going forward with your business as normal? Are any changes going to be made?
There's a huge sigh of relief for the moment, but I don't think we're ever going to stop fighting this, because that's just the way it's been. Like, the people that are against it don't want to hear us, and there's just always somebody that'll push this sort of agendas forward. I can't speculate as to what New York City will do, but they have the right to appeal. So they may appeal, they may do something else, but for the time being, it's a tremendous win, and that's all I can do, have this win and this breath of fresh air, and then when they come, we just have to be ready to keep going.
The New York City Law Department told Radio Catskill, "We believe the city has the authority to implement this local law, which is intended solely to ban the sale of Wagwan in the city. The law in no way restricts or regulates upstate farms. We are carefully reviewing this ruling and determining the next steps." Congressman Mark Marilano for the New York 19, which covers Sullivan County, said on the court's decision, "A New York City ban on foie gras would devastate those who can least afford it in Sullivan County, where duck and goose farming account for millions of dollars in economic output. I've been fighting alongside our farming community in hopes that the court would see the New York City's ban as it is, government overreach. The decision marks another victory in our fight. New York City should not be allowed to meddle in upstate New York's agricultural industry." Also, Sullivan County's District 6 legislator Louis Alvarez, who joined the workers and the farm owners in 2019 on the steps of City Hall and is a strong supporter of the farms, said, "Well, over 400 people and many local businesses depend on the continued existence and success of a foie gras farms. These agricultural operations play a crucial role in both our local economy and culture, and I'm very happy the New York State Supreme Court has reaffirmed their right to function free of unreasonable government interferences." Sergio told me that COVID was a good example of how it would be if the ban did take effect. He said the shutdown of New York City restaurants during the height of COVID drastically affected his operations.
It puts you at a point where you're not gonna survive. And COVID was a perfect example of that. When New York City said they said we're closing all restaurants, there's no way we would have made it without like assistance from the government, with the PPP loans, with the SBA loans. There's no way we're gonna make it. So that was a perfect illustration of what's gonna happen to us if New York City is allowed to do this ban. We would be out of business. And for us, for our company, that was the biggest fear. Okay, we're going to have to let go of everybody that's been working with us for 20 plus years. So yeah. I was like, how do you do that? And that's why they don't understand. Like, we can't stop fighting, because this is people we're fighting for.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, a member curated art exhibition at the Wayne County Arts Alliance. They're first. This is Radio Catskill.
This week on Science Friday, kids are getting their menstrual periods earlier than previous generations. Plus, trying to clean up the River Seine before the Paris Summer Olympics.
What we see is not necessarily a sign that the infrastructure projects are not working. They might be working, and the river is also polluted from upstream.
That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Today, from 2 to 4 p.m., on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, an effort to remind the country of the humanity in all of us. I'm Isabel Braverman, and we are pairing up strangers in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania to have conversations, not debates. Get to know your neighbors. Let's take one small step away from division and toward each other. Sign up at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Wayne County Arts Alliance Gallery announced its first members curated exhibition with the opening of Threads Fiber Artworks. That's today and on view through July 28th. An artist's reception will be held tonight at 5. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to WCAA member artists Katharina Lichtman and Buff McAllister, whose fiber art is resonant of both traditional quilt making and fine artworks.
Good morning, Katharina and Buff, and welcome to Radio Chatskill, ladies.
Thank you.
It's so nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Pleasure.
So let's begin. So, Buff, you have been doing textiles for many, many, many years.
My whole life, basically.
Your whole life.
Yeah. I have ancestors who have been in the textile business, weavers, sewers, tailors. My grandmother was a tailor in a men's shirt factory, the forewoman, I should say, of a tailor in a men's shirt factory. And my mother learned to sew, and my sister taught me to sew. And so it's, you come down the generations.
Okay. And those generations, there was a lot of home, as part of homemaking, a lot of textile work.
Oh, yes, very much so. Yeah. I made most of my own clothes as I got into mid school and high school. And then I went on for a textile degree in college. I went to the University of Delaware and got a BS in textiles and clothing. We learned fashion design and flat pattern design and draping.
Yeah, wonderful.
Tailoring, that kind of stuff.
And it's interesting because textiles was not really focused on very much in the art world.
No, not at all.
You have
a lot of people still don't quite get it, that it's an art form.
Yes, yes. And Katharina.
Yes. Well, I too have sewn all my life, actually, with my started with my grandmother as a small kid during the summer vacations. But then I basically, I made clothes for myself, but I didn't really take anything serious until I met a friend up here, somebody who says, why don't you join the quilting group?
Uh-huh.
And so there is a group that meets at the extension every month and every Thursday.
That's Cornell Cooperative Extension.
Right. And so that was about 25, 30 years ago.
Whoa.
Yeah. So I've been traditional quilting in the beginning, and then I turned to more self-design. You know, I took classes and went to seminars for a whole week on quilting camps and so. And so that's how I got into it.
And you said you studied at what college?
Parsons. Yes.
And when you were there, what was your field?
Mostly clothing.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's hear a little bit about what you'll be exhibiting, because I'm sure you both have a wide range of work, and you'll be exhibiting only a portion of it. So what will that be, Buff?
Well, I'm exhibiting a series I have done called Dreaming of Water. I've gotten kind of obsessed with water, with the current issues of climate change and water conservation, so on and so forth. And many of my pieces have I hope it's a subtle reminder.
Okay.
About water conservation, how important it is, how beautiful it is, how overwhelming it can be in certain aspects, you know, floods and so on. So many of my pieces deal with water that are in this particular show.
And what sizes are they?
Most of them are about 24 by 30 inches in a vertical direction. And then I have several pieces that are just talk about water, not water necessarily, in, but about resources in general. I call them my earth gems, where, you know, humans are very fond of the gems that come out of the earth, you know, emeralds and rubies and so on. But the real gems of life are the things that they come out of, the soil, the water, the grasses, the prairies. Those are the real gems of our lives.
Okay.
Not the little shiny nuggets.
What a lovely or beautiful reminder.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. And do you have any special materials that you use or fabrics that you like better than others? Or
I mostly use just plain quilting type fabrics, mostly cotton.
Okay.
Thin weight, like a blouse weight fabric.
Okay.
I do a tiny bit of dyeing, but I really don't enjoy it that much.
Uh-huh.
So I mostly use commercial fabrics. And what I do is I use something that's called raw edge applique, which means that you just cut out the piece and then you applique it onto the background. And I use zigzag stitches to hold it into place and then quilting stitches to hold the whole thing into place.
Wonderful. And Katharina?
My pieces are, I started out with traditional Amish pieces.
Okay.
Yes. And some of those are in the show. And then I started to dye my own fabric. So the pieces have changed. But in this show, it's mostly my abstracts. But I love animals. So I have a whole category of animals on my website. None of that. This show is really just abstract pieces.
And what kind of materials do you use, or do you have favorites?
In the beginning, I used commercial cottons.
Yes.
And now mostly my own dyes, but I mix it up.
Well, okay.
Whatever fits, you know.
Okay.
Because dyeing is a lot of work, and it's messy.
Oh, very messy.
Yes. So I stopped dyeing.
And what are the sizes of your pieces?
Maybe 20 by 30 or longer, or
okay.
20 by 50, some of them. I make some smaller pieces also. Not everybody has a big wall space.
That's why I was asking.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also they become expensive when they're big. You know, they take a lot of time.
Of course. Yes,
take a lot of time.
Of course they do.
And so not everybody is willing to part with their money.
Yes. Yeah, we get that.
Yeah.
We get that. But it's wonderful that we have these arts organizations here in our community where we get to see the work of people like yourselves that put so much time and energy. I'm always shocked when some of my friends who are artists, I learn how long it takes to make a piece.
Yes.
I mean, it's you never really could get an hourly wage for it.
No, it would be definitely below minimum wage.
Yes, yes, it's definitely below minimum wage. Is there anything else either of you would like to add about the show, about yourselves, about textiles?
Well, one thing I would like to say is give a tip of the hat to the Wayne County Arts Alliance. They've been great. They've really are enthusiastic and very friendly and very kind, and they've put together a beautiful building. They've managed to get a building there in Honesdale and done a beautiful job renovating it, and I'm very grateful to them for giving us this opportunity.
And, Buff, could you give us your website?
Sure. It's www.BuffMacFiberDesigns.com.
Beautiful, because I'm sure folks will love to see your work.
Oh, I see.
And Katharina Lichman, her website is Art Quilts by MIETZI.com. And in either case, you can just put in their names, and it'll pop up. Okay. Katharina, is there anything you would like to add?
Well, I think that most people think of quilting as a pot lid holder. So,
as a what?
Pot lid holder.
Okay.
So, you know, art quilting is really like painting. We paint with fabric. And if you look closely when you go to the show, closely at our stitching, you know, which is quite intricate sometimes.
Oh, sure.
And it takes a lot of time.
You know, yeah.
A lot of ripping out. Do it over.
And Katharina does beautiful free motion stitching. That's where you're moving the needle and the piece sort of together without the machine interfering. And it's very hard to do because you've got to get the timing just right to have a nice-looking stitch. And she does a great job with that.
Yeah.
I'm not so good at it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I just learned something. You know, there's so much we don't know about so many things. I must say, I was at an art exhibit was a women's art exhibit at Monmouth Museum in New Jersey. And part of the exhibit was all textiles by women.
Hmm.
And they were simply astounding. Astounding. And they had bowls and, you know, you name it, but it was quite exceptional to see as well what can be done, that it's definitely art.
Yeah, and it is 3D to three-dimensional pieces are possible with fabric. It's quite
interesting. Yes, yes, yeah.
I'd like to say that we both of them work on commercial, home machines.
Home machines?
Yeah, because a lot of the quilters have now these very large machines.
Okay.
That they can program to do things.
Oh, okay.
But they don't necessarily program. They can also just guide them. But they're huge machines, and we have our little, you know, cubby holes there.
Okay.
So it's a different way of sewing.
Okay. This is wonderful information because, you know, we don't know that much about textile work like we do about a lot of other art forms.
Yes, it's taken a long time for art quilting to come into a feeling of art as opposed to craft.
And,
you know, often as Katharina says, you put something on the wall and somebody says, oh, is that a placemat or something? Or how can you wash that, you know, or something like that, you know? But the art quilting field has absolutely exploded over the last few years, and it's just really very exciting to see what people are doing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You go to one of these shows, and they're...
Okay, ladies. Well, it was wonderful having you both here.
Well, thank you for
having us. Let's just repeat that your exhibit called Threads opens on Friday, June 28th, and runs through July 28th. And you can go to the Wayne County Arts Alliance website for more information.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Valerie.
Thank you.
Culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaking to Wayne County Arts Alliance fiber artists Katharina Littman and Buff McAllister. We're going to go, but before we do, I want to remind you again about One Small Step. That's that partnership with StoryCorps where we seek to counteract the intensifying political divides in our country by facilitating and recording conversations that enable people who disagree to listen to each other with respect. So think about it. Maybe there's a One Small Step conversation you can have. If so, go to our website, wjffradio.org, click on the StoryCorps One Small Step button there, and sign up. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting, because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving four counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
I'm Aaron Bendish. Join me for Borscht Beat, the Jewish music show on Radio Catskill. Each week I share rare, forgotten, and classic recordings from Jewish musical traditions across multiple generations, from Yiddish folk songs to instrumental klezmer, Yiddish theater, and contemporary performances. It's a grand tour of many musical landscapes. That's Borscht Beat, an hour of Jewish music in the Catskills, Sunday afternoons at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, Angela Page here from Folk Plus. Every week when I prepare my show, I draw from favorites over the last 40 years and from a few dozen new arrivals. My aim is to curate a playlist of the best of the singer-songwriters currently available. Join me Sundays at 4 and see who your next favorite artist might be.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill. Today's weather, sunny and nice, high 74. Increasing clouds tonight, low 56. And then for the weekend, rain and a thunderstorm from tomorrow afternoon to Sunday afternoon. Some of those might be heavy and could lead to flooding. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.